This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Thursday, April 18th. The Speaker of the Ontario Legislature defends his decision to ban the keffiyeh, a move the Premier says he doesn't support. We'll cover the latest on the unfolding controversy at Queen's Park and talk to Ontario NDP leader Merritt Stiles. Plus, pushback against the big tax changes in the federal budget. The Power Panel joins us on that. And former Health Minister Jane Philpott says fixing Canada's healthcare system starts with family doctors for all. We'll talk to her about her plan to guarantee every Canadian gets the care they need. The Speaker of Ontario's legislature is defending his decision to ban the wearing of keffiyehs in the chamber.
Procedurally, I believe I made the right decision in the sense of past rulings of speakers and precedents and traditions. And in my opinion, having done the research, it appeared to me that the keffiyeh is being worn to make a political statement.
In a statement earlier this week, the Speaker wrote, "After extensive research, I concluded that the wearing of a keffiyeh at the present time in our Assembly is clearly intended to make a political statement," as you just heard him say. "So as Speaker, I cannot authorize the wearing of it in the chamber." The keffiyeh is a scarf commonly worn by Arabs. It holds special significance to Palestinians as a symbol of resistance and has been seen on pro-Palestinian demonstrators recently as they protest the Israel-Hamas war. Ontario's opposition leader Merritt Stiles put forward a motion this morning calling on the Speaker to reverse this ban, but the motion failed after it did not receive unanimous consent. Conservative MPP Robin Martin voted against the motion, saying the Speaker's initial ruling was the correct one.
I seek unanimous consent.
The Legislative Assembly has rules. Political clothing is not allowed to be worn in the Legislative Assembly. As a member, I have a vote, and I voted to not change that decision because I think it is the correct decision.
Ontario's Premier, on the other hand, says he does not support this ban in the chamber. Here's what he said in a press conference today.
It really comes down to uniting Ontarians and communities. We see the division right now that's going on. It's not healthy, and this would just divide the community even more.
Okay, here to break this all down for us is the Queen's Park Observer's Sabrina Nanji. She's been following this story closely. Sabrina, always good to have you on the show. What have the opposition and the community reactions been to this so far?
Yeah, I mean, once again, the Middle East has scrambled Ontario politics, right? And actually, all major party leaders happen to be on the same page. They're aligned against the Speaker's ban on the keffiyeh. But when it came time for Doug Ford's government to walk the talk, his MPP was the one that actually shut down unanimous consent that had been put forward by the NDP. It's not really lost on anyone at Queen's Park that this is happening against the backdrop of a tight by-election race in Milton, where there is a big Muslim community. And so I think timing is everything here. We're talking about parliamentary convention. We know that political props are a no-no, as the Speaker said. But the NDP in particular are saying that Ford has clearly lost control of his caucus. He says one thing, MPPs are doing the opposite, and it's chaos. Meanwhile, we've got critics saying that the Premier is just, politicking here. He's pandering to the Muslim community because there's a by-election on. It's the 905. I have a vote-rich, politically important region. But certainly, I think, the calls that are coming from inside Doug Ford's own house and some of the dissent among conservative caucus members on how this all went down, I think is maybe the most damning politically for Doug Ford right now.
Well, let's just talk a little bit more about that by-election in Milton, right? That is one that everybody is watching because of the dynamic at play. I mean, how do you see this necessarily impacting the vote there?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is no doubt a big Muslim community in Milton, and so I think they will be paying attention. I don't know if, folks in the Muslim community are seeing this as, electioneering. But at the end of the day, I think, as Doug said, he says that this is something that's divisive. What I'm hearing from the folks in the Jewish community, actually, is that this is something that did not need to be so politicized. It's already so charged already. And by putting out a statement, less than 2 hours after the news broke of this, I think Doug Ford really he came out strongly against this. He forced Bonnie Crombie. Marsh Stiles wrote a letter to the speaker that's kind of, you know, more in line with how these things get handled. But they're saying that this has now become something political. It's fueled the headlines on it and created something bigger than maybe it needed to be. Whereas they're seeing this as, you know, something that could have been turned around if the House wanted that too. And the legislature, you know, Robin Martin in particular, voted against it.
You know, in normal issues, Sabrina, when the premier says they want something, the caucus falls into line, but this is definitely not a normal issue. We saw Robin Martin there represents Eglinton Lawrence, which is the same provincial riding as Marco Mendicino federally, and a significant Jewish population, and obviously this is of big importance to that constituency. But what are you hearing about other members of the caucus who may not be happy with this? What can you share on that?
Yeah, Robin Martin is not the only one. And as you mentioned, we kind of maybe expected her to have this stance on this particular issue. But there are others that have been coming out. I've been hearing that Environment Minister Andrea Kangin, she's really not happy about this. Laura Smith over in Thornhill, another big Jewish community there. Stephen Lecce has always been very vocal. Solicitor General Michael Kirzner. I think just the timing of this, you know, caucus obviously wasn't consulted. And I think that, you know, for Doug Ford to be up there saying one thing and his caucus, especially after being, you know, informed, if you don't want to vote or if you want to vote against the unanimous consent motion to reverse this ban, you know, stay out of it, stay out of the House, just sit this one out. Obviously, that didn't happen. And I have to say, you know, conservative MPPs are feeling very chatty with us reporters right now. And that's always, you know, a bad sign that maybe your dirty laundry is going to get aired right now, and a sign that caucus, it really isn't happy with how this is playing out.
Okay, well, Sabrina, if you get any more good dirty laundry, let us know. We'll have you back. That's Sabrina Nanji. She covers Ontario politics and policy for the Queen's Park Observer. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
For more on this story, I'm joined by Ontario NDP leader Merritt Stiles. Ms. Stiles, welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
You put forward this unanimous consent motion this morning to undo the speaker's ruling. Why was it important for you to do this?
Well, first of all, I mean, obviously, I've been back and forth with the speaker over the last week. As soon as I learned that this was that few staff had been asked to remove the keffiyeh when they were entering the building, and also some guests of the legislature had been asked to remove it, so it had come to our attention that some policy had changed. But certainly yesterday, when it started to become more public, I was pleased that the premier joined me in the same call for a change in this policy. Unfortunately, when we brought forward the unanimous consent motion this morning, which literally requires that there be nobody who says no when the speaker says, you know, does everybody agree? There were voices saying no, certainly at least one and maybe more voices on the conservative side. So we were surprised that given that the premier, so both the leader of the official opposition and the premier had said they have a problem with this policy and don't want it supported, that we would lose that unanimous consent motion.
It is a rare moment when you and Doug Ford are on the same side, that we have seen it recently with things like intimate partner violence and on this one today. But what does it say to you that he couldn't get his caucus to go along with him on this? What does it say about his control of the caucus and his alignment with his caucus on this particular issue?
Well, honestly, I hate to even speculate. I don't know whether he expected that or not. He was not in the legislature himself, in the chamber. But the premier needs to make sure that his team does the right thing. It's as simple as that. And in this case, they did not.
So on this, there is the social conflict that is happening across the country, you know, driven by what's been happening in the Middle East since October 7th. But then there are also the rules of the legislature that bans props and political expressions. And I know the keffiyeh has a cultural resonance with people, importance with people, but it's also been seen as a symbol of the Palestinian movement. And the speaker has ruled that that conflicts with the lack of political science. Garments and expressions inside the legislature. We saw the House of Commons, though, where the federal NDP, where a lot of them were wearing this when they voted in favor of the recent controversial resolution in Israel. How does Speaker Arnett justify this, in your view?
Well, you're right. He does say that he's looked into the matter, and in his opinion and based on his research, he thinks that it has become a political symbol more recently. That's his argument. I would differ with that. I mean, I would say that And certainly when you look, as you said, in Parliament federally and in other legislatures across the country, the keffiyeh is seen as a cultural attire. It's, yes, associated with the Palestinian Arab identity. Mm-hmm. So Arab Muslims, Arab Palestinians wear the keffiyeh. But in that sense, it's not so different from other items of clothing that also have a strong cultural connection for people, connection back to their cultural heritage and identity. Palestinians are Palestinians, and that is a garment connected to their culture and community. And so in that sense, I think it's not much different than other things. And I pointed out to the speaker that, you know, many of the clothing items that we allow in the legislature now, and rightly so, were also once associated with political oppression or resistance. So you think of like the kilt at one time, the kirpan. You know, certainly today, many of us and many people of Ukrainian descent are wearing very proudly their Ukrainian attire because there's also a conflict happening in their country and they want to, you know, maintain that connection close to home and community. So I do think that it's a slippery slope. I acknowledge that there's people out there in with close connections to the region who have a lot of pain. I absolutely know that and see that. But I do think that that shouldn't get in the way of people being able to wear the attire that connects them to their community and their heritage. And that's a really important part of who we are as Canadians.
But just on the ban, it's not just inside the chamber itself, right? You were saying your staff were being asked to take it off just when they entered the building. Like if you're going, because you have offices and stuff. Am I understanding that correctly? You can't just wear it.
Yeah, it's the legislative precinct. So, for example, if you were to enter the building, whether you're there for a meeting or to watch things in the chamber, you would be asked to take it off. It's not just about MPP sitting in the chamber. It's anybody else. And so it is quite a significant move. Certainly within the chamber, as you said, we aren't allowed to use props. There's all kinds of rules around what we can do as MPPs. I can't wear a button or anything or a flag or something that hasn't been basically approved. But things like wearing your traditional cultural attire and stuff is a little different and has always, up until now, been, I think, been allowed.
Right. And certainly when I raised that earlier, I wasn't trying to define it as a prop. I was just trying to explain the rules and the restrictions that exist in place so people at home would understand it. But so you tried to get this done with the unanimous motion today. It didn't happen. The speaker has said he would change the policy if there is a unanimous consent. That seems unlikely at this point in time, given that one or more members of Doug Ford's caucus have voted against it. So what do you do now? Can you force a vote on this in normal means that requires maybe a recorded vote or a show of hands on this as opposed to unanimous consent? What do you do to try to push this through?
Yeah, well, obviously, I'm disappointed that it didn't pass. But that doesn't change our position. And so we will be looking at other options. The legislature will be rising until Monday. It'll be coming back on Monday morning. I'm urging every member of the legislature to do the right thing to support our call. And if that means another motion or another unanimous consent, we will do it. But again, I've heard the premier, who's the head of the government, they have a majority, say that he supports undoing this ban by the speaker. And I know the speaker is open to that if he has the will of the room, of all sides. And so I really need the premier again to I'm glad he joined my call. I need him to do the right thing and make sure that his team is also doing the right thing.
Now, the speaker is nominally independent from the government, of course, you know, and reigns supreme inside Parliament in terms of setting the rules. But would you consider going as far as to formally challenge the ruling of the chair and force a vote on this? I know that's a bit more conflict-oriented than you were hoping to go on this, on what's already been a divisive issue. But if the speaker won't move, absent unanimity, that's one way to get it done.
I mean, absolutely, that's not something I want to take lightly. The role of the speaker is very important, and I'm trying to be as respectful as I can here, certainly. But, you know, we will look at all the options that we have. And I will be following up with the speaker as well to hopefully discuss with him what his thoughts are now, because he did make a statement today that he was open to changing that. And he recognized that leaders of both sides had come to an agreement about this. But again, I mean, if there's going to continue to be outliers within his caucus, you know, the premier is going to have to address that. I will be looking at all the options we have. I certainly don't want people to feel unwelcome. No Ontarian should feel unwelcome in the Ontario legislature. We always call it the house, right? You know, I always say, this is your house. This is your home. This is where we make decisions that impact you. And people should have the right to be there, to be comfortable in who they are and in their community and their culture and their connections to home.
So this is a final question. The speaker could change his mind and change the decision on their own without anything needing to happen. Do you get any indication that that is a possible path forward here?
Well, so far he hasn't indicated that when he wrote back to me on Tuesday. So we'll see if that changes. In the meantime, I'm sure that he is a thoughtful person, and I'm sure he's having a lot of important conversations. I've received thousands of emails of all supportive, essentially saying they were thanking me for standing up for this, and I'm happy to continue to do so. And I'm sure that the speaker is having some important conversations now, too. Hopefully, this won't divide us further. It'll lead to an opportunity for more understanding and coming together to ensure that every Ontarian feels welcome in the legislature.
Ontario NDP leader Merritt Stiles, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
The business community is pushing back against some tax changes in the federal budget. And yesterday, former Trudeau Liberal Finance Minister Bill Morneau called the move a disincentive for investment.
For those people that have larger capital gains that have already been accrued, or people that are trying to make investments for significant capital gains over time, we've created a disincentive. And that's very difficult. I don't think there's any way to put a sugar coating on top of it. It's a challenge.
Okay, we're going to bring in the power panel, see if they will sugarcoat this one. Cameron Amott is a former head of communications to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He's going to connect with us in a second from Montreal. James Moore is a former Conservative cabinet minister. There he is. Shachi Curl is the president of the Angus Reid Institute. And here with me in studio, former NDP MP Matthew Dubé. James, let's start with you in those Bill Morneau comments. Oh, Cameron, you're there. Excellent. Cameron, can you hear me? I'm just double checking. Yes?
Hear you, yeah.
You can hear me. Okay.
Technical things here.
Okay, all right. You know what? I'll go to James first and come to you after that. James, you heard what Bill Morneau had to say there. We're a long way from him and Justin Trudeau making hard hands on billboards in Toronto a few years ago, as he's now criticizing their fiscal policy here. What do you make of this pushback against the tax measures in the federal budget?
Well, it's appropriate. Look, what you tax, you get less of. What you subsidize, you get more of. And this change will have create an environment and a perception that Canada is not a place for investment capital, certainly relative to our trading partner in the United States. Also, though, important to remember that, you know, if you're going to put in place a capital gains increase like this, and you're going to include in that the sale of property, you need to sell land in order to build more homes. And if people are currently sitting on land thinking about possibly selling it, you're going to have a disincent on that, because people are maybe waiting for 12 months, 24 months, 36 months with a possible change in government and a post election year budget next year with the Liberals to see if Pierre Poilievre might change this policy back. So the need to build more homes requires the need for more land to be transacted to build those homes. And if you're going to put a new tax in place on that, then a lot of people may not be disposing of their land, which is necessary in order to build housing in places like Vancouver, where land is of a real premium. So I think, you know, there's also concerns that have been raised by the Premier of Ontario about doctors and family doctors and the way in which they have historically arranged their finances and what this inclusion rate will mean. So I think there's a lot of knock-on effects here that are going to have real impact on the economy and the perception of Canada as an effective place to invest your risk income.
Shachi, the pushback from the government on this has been that this change in the capital gains inclusion rate brings capital gains in line with the taxation rate on dividends and share buybacks, and that if the lower capital gains inclusion rate was the magic bullet for productivity gains, then we would have had, as a country, real high productivity rates in the past number of years when the persistent complaint has been productivity has been too low. I mean, what's your sense on where things are on this?
Well, I mean, first of all, the length of that explanation that you did a very good job of re-explaining, David, is such that most people who have never had a capital gain to sell at over $250,000, let alone worry about the tax on it, you know, you've already, they're not paying attention to this in the same way. What they are hearing is tax the rich, eat the rich. That's the perception. For the business community, this is absolutely going to be a problem. They are going to see it as a problem politically, and what are they going to do about it? Watched if they haven't already put their Bay Street dollars, and not just Bay Street. Let me be really clear. There are going to be doctors involved in this. There are going to be grandparents or others who are thinking about selling property, divesting that, handing the money to their kids, who may be thinking twice. But I would just say, let's wait and see the extent to which either this moves the needle politically back against the Liberal government, which would I don't think that's going to be the case at all. I think that the political hit for the government on this, unless we really start to see lobby groups and others who are affected effectively politically coalescing against the issue. But really, I think the more important thing is to monitor to what extent all of this spending that is predicating this tax increase is going to move the needle, particularly for the Liberals who are in trouble, as we all know, and particularly among Gen Z and younger millennials. If it doesn't do anything, if we don't see any of those spending announcements moving things back towards the Liberals in any meaningful way, shape, or form, it does say to me that the Liberals have just covered, that the Canadians have covered their ears right where the Liberals are concerned and what they have to say. So this is a bit of a sidebar to a sidebar, but it's part of a larger story around, can the Liberals themselves tell a better story with this budget?
You know, Cameron, though, I wonder what this does in terms of moving the needle in terms of investment, in terms of economic growth, because if you listen to the responses of the Business Council of Canada, the Chamber of Commerce, Canadian Federation of Independent Business, they're concerned about this. The government feels they've done enough in increasing the lifetime exemption threshold, the entrepreneur credit, to offset some of that, and also argue that it's about fairness and making wealthy people pay for the challenges of the country. Where do you think this lands, Cameron?
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, time will tell if this will move the needle economically, if it will move the needle for the government and for perception. But telling a story is exactly what they want to do. And I think they're setting themselves up to have a fight that they want to have, to try and corner the conservatives into being forced to saying, you know, to defending cutting taxes for the wealthy, and to tell people what they're going to cut and what types of investments they don't actually support. So I think this is the story that they're trying to build and the political battle lines that they're trying to draw out over the next year. And this budget gives them the tools and the meat to do that. It's all about fairness. It's all about, you know, generational fairness, helping younger people, showing parents and grandparents that they're thinking about their kids' future. And if they keep it simple, talking about taxing a little bit more, the 1% of the 1% of the wealthiest Canadians is something that's going to be very popular. And it sort of reminds me of 2015 when Justin Trudeau announced his tax cut on the middle class and raising the taxes on the wealthiest Canadians. That was something that he campaigned on, that he was really happy to talk about, and it resonated really well. We'll see, how it evolves over the next few months, and whether this is actually something that can move the needle. But I think it gives them a strong set of material to draw that fight out and make it a very clear contrast between, you know, the government, the Liberals saying, we're investing in the next generation. We're actually trying to grow the economy by investing in things you need and care about right now. And the way we're going to pay for that is by asking the wealthiest few and some corporations to pay a little bit more on their extra passive income.
Right. So Matthew, it is for individuals. It is a small subset of the Canadian population, but it's all corporations now, whether it's like an incorporated professional practice, like a law practice or a doctor's office, they're now paying the higher rate on capital investment. And now, look, the government argues that this equalizes it with other rates, but there is some pushback from family doctors at a time when there aren't enough doctors in this country. I mean, there is some risk in this move.
Yeah, definitely. I think The morning after the budget, what I thought they did well was, I still get a paper newspaper at home, if you can believe it, and the headline was the capital gains tax. It wasn't anything about the deficit or things like that, things that the government wants to avoid. Mm-hmm. So I bet in that moment, they're happy. I think where they've lost the plot a little bit is now the conversation's become, rightly or wrongly, about exactly what you identified, whether it's doctors, but also into people who aren't clear on whether this jeopardizes their retirement or their estates or things of that nature, right? Selling property, what's going to happen with their RSPs. Some of that's inaccurate. Some of it's accurate. Some of it's inaccurate. But the point is that that's the conversation that's happening now. And I think that's the big challenge. Whereas, you could have taken a more simple measure of increasing corporate tax rates in such a way where Canada can remain competitive, but that it's much clearer to Canadians who's actually being targeted. And I think in a budget where a lot of the things that are good require a lot of explanation around housing and things like that, and also won't happen immediately, and a lot of the things that could have been better, like a disability benefit that's welcome, is inadequate in the eyes of many, and a situation like this with the capital gains tax, where it's that old adage in politics, which I feel I repeat all too often on your show, is when you're explaining, you're losing. So I think that's really the situation that they found themselves in, and I think it would have been better complemented with something more tangible for the cost of living as a crisis, right? In order to help Canadians feel that there's actually some direct support. I'm not necessarily saying everyone needs to have a check cut to them or anything like that, but I think it's not clear to a lot of people who's actually going to be most affected by this, despite the fact that, those of us who know, but it's that's the government has to explain it to the majority of Canadians.
Well, yeah, I mean, James, look, the vast majority of Canadians don't have capital gains in excess of $250,000 in a single year, which is when the tax even kicks in the first place, and let alone the higher inclusion rate. So the vast majority of Canadians are not going to be affected by this. Corporations, though, this is going to be a challenge for them of all sizes, though the CFIB says most small businesses will probably be protected by increasing the lifetime capital gains exemption. But the argument from the government is that even with this, that the marginal effective tax rate is still the lowest in the G7. You're still competitive with California and New York, the big economies you're competing with for tech and innovation because of the other measures they brought in. Do you buy that argument? When you look at the math, does it add up to you?
Well, the government would say that, but the people who are actually in the business of competing with those other jurisdictions say it's not so. But look, you're right about the macro of this. Like, the capital gains inclusion rate used to be 75%. Mm-hmm. It was brought down to 50% by the Liberals. Now it's being brought up to 2/3 by the Liberals. So the number has fluctuated in the past over time. But what they're also doing is they're increasing the lifetime's earning from $750 up to $1 million, and they're not touching principal residences for capital gains. Mm-hmm. So this idea of class warfare, we're standing up for the little guy, looking up for intergenerational transfers of wealth that Cameron described, it's not happening, number one, on that side. So what was sort of promised going into the budget with the leaks and the expectations that there's going to be this effort to rebalance things and to be class warriors on behalf of a generation of people who don't have none of that is happening. But what is happening is the consequence in the back end, which is what we've been talking about for a long time and the Bank of Canada has warned about, which is a problem of an inadequate dynamic in the Canadian economy, of an inflow of capital, which is going to spur the productivity, which will spur the jobs, which will spur the growth, which will then spur the tax revenue that allows us to have the social programs that we all need and rely on in order to have a more equitable and decent society. So on the front end, if you're going to handicap that with these kinds of tax measures relative to our competition, the business community who actually does business in this space, not the politicians and the bureaucrats, yeah, but the people who are actually in this space, they say this is a problem and they should be listened to.
Okay, Cameron, I want to move the conversation a bit to the argument you were talking about, the what are you going to keep, what are you going to cut dynamic they're trying to put on the table for Pierre Poilievre. And he did an interview today, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre did, on why he opposes this budget and what he doesn't like about it. And this is what he said to City News host Rob Snow about the PharmaCare plan. This is a radio clip. Have a listen to this.
Most of your listeners already have coverage through their workplace. The PharmaCare bill Trudeau's brought forward would ban that and require you move over to a federal government plan, not a workplace plan, a federal government plan. So I will not be supporting any plan like the one in the Liberal government's bill that would ban you from having a workplace drug coverage.
Okay, that was Pierre Poilievre today. That comment prompted this response from Health Minister Mark Holland. Have a listen.
Entirely dishonest. I think what we're seeing is he doesn't want to have a conversation about the real issue. He creates fake boogeymen. He tries to scare people. And to me, fine, you want to vote against it because you don't believe that, that everybody should have access to the medicine they need? Then fine. But be honest about it. Be honest that that's what it's about. Don't try to create fake issues or hide in shadows.
Okay, Cameron, on that, there's nothing in anything, the government and the NDP, who they negotiated pharmacare with, that says they're going to ban you from having your workplace plan. In fact, they've given assurances that your workplace coverage will be preserved under whatever measure they bring in. What do you make of this move by Pierre Poilievre and the pushback by the Liberals there?
Well, I wish I could say I'm shocked and I'm surprised and this is outrageous and I can't believe that the leader of the opposition would make something up like this, but it's the pattern. It's how he communicates. It's what he does to try and distract from the real issues. Like the real issue here, and you can disagree with it, as Mark Holland said, I think he did a great job of responding, is the federal government is trying to fill a gap and make sure that people have access to essential medications, pharmaceutical products that they can't afford. And they're going to work with provinces. They're going to pass legislation. They're going to try and get that done. You can disagree with that in principle. You can say, I don't believe the government should do that. I think it should be up to people to figure that out themselves. I think it should be the responsibility of the provinces. Whatever. You can have a healthy partisan debate about it. And frankly, that's what a healthy democracy is all about. What he's doing is completely dishonest. And yet again, he is just trying to deceive people and scaremonger people by just telling them, by making stuff up. It's really disappointing. And it's good to see, good to hear, you know, a liberal minister, Minister Holland, try and dispel what he's saying and actually fight back. He does this all the time. It's become sort of a staple, and I think the Conservative Party has been doing this on a number of issues for a long time. But you know, we got to fight back, and it's not an honest way that our discourse in this country should be held. It's
right.
We should be able to have these debates, and they can be partisan, and they can be strong, and people can clash, but they should be based on the facts.
So Shachi, on this, I mean, you know, your polling, all the polling shows, there's a lot of reasons people are upset with this government right now. There's plenty of ammunition to use against them politically. Is there a risk in sort of inventing one? Because, like, while we haven't seen the final plan, there is no evidence anywhere to say this is the intention of what is coming.
Yeah, so let's just do facts on Canadian access to pharmacare and Canadian access to prescription drugs. One in five Canadians are either skipping doses, skipping prescriptions, splitting pills, or in other ways not taking their medication as prescribed due to cost. Full stop. One in five. So is he technically right when he says most Canadians? Sure. But I don't know that leaving behind 20% of the population on this issue is acceptable. Also, the correlation between illness, sickness, disability, and chronic underemployment means that in many, many cases, the people who need that coverage the most are not working, or they're not working enough to qualify for a work plan, let alone be able to afford those drugs on their own. So, it is so important to do baseline facts on this issue. Those are the baseline facts, and of full stop. Now, to your question about does he need to invent or come up with just blatantly wrong stuff, I don't know who briefed him. I don't know what's in his head. I don't know why he's doing it. But to your point, there are, pick 'em. There is a smorgasbord of issues where the Conservatives have effectively or could effectively take the fight to this government after almost 9 years on policy, on deliverables, on wedgeology and divisiveness, on all sorts of things. I don't get where this is coming from. I don't understand why. And, you know, frankly, Conservatives who need prescription access, Conservatives need prescription access too. People who would vote for Pierre Poilievre are also people who need access to their medication.
Matthew, you know, this is something the New Democrats push. Nowhere in it is it, as he says, this would ban having a workplace drug plan. I mean, nowhere in the plan is that mentioned.
No, not at all. It truly is completely false, like the minister said. But I think My biggest takeaway from this is how the House of Cards starts to crumble when he's challenged on what he would do about existing or soon to be existing programs that benefit Canadians that have been brought in through the collaboration of the NDP and the Liberals. Because I don't know if he repeated this in English, but just the other day he was also saying that the dental care program would go away. He was saying this in French in a French language interview that program would disappear. I look forward to hearing what he'll have to say about the child care program, which for those who have had children in childcare in provinces other than Quebec know that it's essentially a second mortgage.
So I think he has said he will keep that.
Well, fair enough. That's fair. And I think, but the point that I think is most important here is to start challenging on these issues. You know, it's great to talk exclusively about the carbon tax, but when we're talking about an affordability crisis, there's also a lot of other things that come into play, including the cost of medication, the cost of dental care for those who aren't insured, to the point that was just made. And so it's important that he starts to get challenged on them, and it's pretty troubling to see that when he does get challenged on them, there's this type of quite frankly, blatant lies that are put out there about what's actually being proposed.
So, James, just to close the loop on this topic before we move on to the next one, I mean, there's lots of ammunition for the opposition to use to criticize a government that's struggling. Why choose something like this?
Well, look, yesterday's budget pointed out that spending year over year is going to go up 7% on an economy that is growing 1% year over year, with an increase of our immigration and population inflow by 3%, which is to say the 1% number means our per capita GDP is going down. Our unemployment rate is double that of the United States. There are tax measures in this budget that are going to disincent investment, which is going to disincent job growth, which is going to disincent tax revenues that are needed for all of these programs. So it's one thing for the government and for others to line up all these programs and to say they're all worthy because we have all kinds of needs in our society. That's true. But at the end of the day, you have to pay for these things. And if you don't, the intergenerational transfer and inequity to the next generation of Canadians is unsustainable. It's a perfectly worthy question to ask Pierre Poilievre and somebody who wants to aspire to be prime minister of this country, what would you cut and how would you align your priorities? And it's perfectly reasonable for him to say, the election's not for a year and a half. We need to know what the fiscal framework and dynamic of the country looks like so we know what the economy is capable of shouldering in terms of a burden that's been put on us by these expanding programs and what our priorities are. It's a perfectly reasonable debate.
Absolutely on that point, but saying that this will ban workplace drug programs is not an accurate statement based on the evidence that's there, right? So it's one thing to say you can't give a definitive answer on your future fiscal plan without seeing the numbers. It's another thing to say something is happening when it's not.
Certainly. And a reasonable pushback and a reasonable counterpunch. I mean, I didn't see the entirety of the interview, but it's also false for the Liberals to say that this is the be-all, end-all, and we have national pharmacare when all they've done is they've actually put in place mandates for a couple of drugs, for a couple of illnesses across the country. They have not put in place national sweeping pharmacare program either. And for them to suggest that everybody's going to be at risk because this program may not continue as they've rhetorically framed it is also a gross mischaracterization of the policy that's in place right now.
Gang, we're out of time, but I appreciate the conversation. Thank you all so much. Chachi Curl, James Moore, Cameron Ahmad, and Matthew Dubé. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
There are more than 7 million Canadians without a family doctor. A former federal health minister, Jane Philpott, thinks she has a plan that could change that. In her new book, Health for All, Philpott lays the foundation for what she calls primary care homes, a home base of sorts that Canadians can go to for all their health care needs, similar to how all Canadians have access to public schooling. Under Philpott's plan, all Canadians would have access to primary health care. I spoke to her last week. Jane Philpott is a former federal minister of health and currently director of the School of Medicine at Queen's University. Jane Philpott, it's good to see you again. Thanks for coming
in. Nice to see you.
Your book, you talk about a reality where every person living in Canada has what they call a primary care home.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we know that there are close to 7 million people in this country who do not have either a family doctor or any other place to go to get primary care. They don't have a front door to the healthcare system. And what I am proposing is that we do what many other countries, particularly in Europe, do, and they guarantee access to everyone in the country to have a primary care team that is publicly funded, a place in their neighborhood to which they are assigned based on their geography, and when they move to another place in the country, they know they will have a place to go to get care.
Okay, you compare this to how the public school system works. So you move into a neighborhood, there's a school or a series of schools that you can sign up for, and that's where you go. So you're talking about a hub or a series of hubs, medical hubs, that you would sign up for, and that's where you go, and we build a system for medical care that's like education.
Doesn't it make so much sense?
It's pretty radical, though, right?
It's radical because we've never done it. And yet we look at our school system and we know that no matter where you move in this country, your child will be able to have access to publicly funded education at the elementary and secondary school level. So we figured it out a long time ago for education. It's time to figure this out for primary care. As I say, there are many countries in the world that do this. Canada has never done that. We've never had that guaranteed access to a primary care team. And I believe the time is now. Now to have that.
Okay. This, though, requires some fundamental changes in how the Canadian medical system is set up, for example. Like, you know, you go to a private doctor's office that is publicly funded, but that's a private corporation and a business. So we're talking about changing the employment relationship and the employment location of family doctors to make something like this work, right?
There would be optional ways that a province could roll this out. I mean, I think it needs to start with the federal leadership level to say this is what Canadians should expect. This is the standard. Every Canadian should have access to a publicly funded primary care team. As you say, there are different ways that you could do that. You could do it through changing and putting doctors in salaried systems so that they would work with a team. The important thing, though, is that there is accountability built into the local level to say when the community grows, we'll actually add a new primary care team because we can't expect the doctors that are currently working to continue to take on more patients as communities grow. But we've never intentionally made it possible and built a system like that for the sake of Canadians' healthcare.
No, so the only purpose-built systems are really hospitals and clinics that are run directly by governments or health boards, right? The family practices, for the most part, are organic. I mean, there's recruitment efforts to get them, but they've kind of spring up because individual doctors decide to.
Exactly. And it kind of worked for us for several decades, but it has clearly fallen apart. As I said, now about 22% of Canadian adults don't have a place to go to get that primary care. I think that this was building up over the last few decades. The pandemic, of course, broke things apart and they've never stitched back together. The problem is then there are lots of people who don't have a place to go to get care. So they're showing up in the emergency department, often with end-stage cancer or with heart disease that could have been prevented. So we're wasting money, of course, but we're also costing people their lives.
So a couple of things. Let's talk just a little bit about jurisdiction. You talk about the need for federal leadership on this, but the delivery of health services is provincial. And as you have seen, they're not getting along too well, the federal and provincial governments. And you point to the European models where you say this works. They have a different government structure. Some are unitary state, you know, just one level of government sort of running everything. So you don't need to worry about jurisdiction. How do you get past all of that, given just the way Canada has historically worked when it comes to these things?
Well, it's an outstanding question. And that's one of the reasons why the last part of my book is about the political determinants of health, because it will take political will to build a system like this. There are a few ways that one could go about this. Historically in healthcare, we've seen that provinces have innovated. You know, way back in the day when hospital insurance and doctor's insurance first came in, it started in Saskatchewan and then was adopted by the rest of the country and built into federal legislation. And if there's a province that wants to go ahead and install a primary care guarantee, that would be fantastic. None of them have done this yet. I think there may be one or two that might think about it, especially if they read the book. But ideally, wouldn't it be great if the federal government and the provinces and territories sat down together and said, for goodness sake, Canadians pay taxes to provinces and we pay taxes to the federal government. Let's get along together. Let's figure out a way that we can actually deliver a health system across this country that works with our shared jurisdiction over health. And I believe that it's possible to do that.
So even if you could find the political alignment to take on a task this large and agree on, you know, a proof of concept, a structure, a system, there's still the human resources challenge, right? You're the director of a medical school. There's people, doctors aren't going into family medicine. We saw a lot of them close their clinics, you know, last week in Ontario to protest administrative burden and cost. There aren't enough nurses. There's post-pandemic burnout. People are leaving the profession. How do you overcome that challenge? Because that seems to be the immediate thing that needs to be solved before anything else can get fixed.
Well, you're quite right that it's one of the ingredients that needs to be solved. I don't think we can do this in a sequential way. We have to actually be working on designing and building the system, making the guarantee and promising to implement it at the same time as the health workforce deals with the issues about why our medical students are not choosing family medicine as a specialty. We also don't have enough primary care nurse practitioners, for example. So it will take some time to build that workforce. But the reality is that what we need to do is move more of the health workforce into the primary care space. At the moment, the bulk of the workforce happens in the illness care space, which is in hospital-based care. And as I said, we could actually prevent some of the burden on hospitals if we had community-based primary care where people had that access to care and the prevention and health promotion that's necessary to keep them out of hospitals.
That question, though, of like why are so few doctors doing family medicine? I think the last time we spoke on the show, you were talking about expanding a program, offering more medical seats or medical school seats strictly for people who wanted to go into family medicine and work in Ontario or work in the area like Barrie and places like that, the Durham region of where that was situated. I mean, why aren't they going in and how are these sort of measures working to solve some of that?
Well, this is certainly an issue that I tackle in the book and propose a number of reasons why family medicine is a less desirable specialty. We're really excited about the program we've developed at Queen's University that attracts students specifically who are committed to family medicine right from the start. So innovations like that will really help. The fundamental challenge, though, is changing the conditions of work and improving those conditions, because our medical students look at the overburdened state of primary care. They see family doctors who are burned out, who spend, you know, 20 hours a week doing their administrative work on top of their clinical work. So some of what I'm talking about in terms of improving the system is being able to develop a system that will be attractive, where the doctors will actually get a holiday periodically, where they will be able to sign out to someone else on the team, and changing the conditions of work so that medical students will see that it's a desirable place to practice. Because I can tell you, as a family doctor, it's a wonderful career.
Because, you know, just as a final point, I've not put the thought into it to write a book, but I always wonder why there isn't sort of a centralized clinic system. The government builds the building, takes the operational costs, puts the administrative staff in there, and then a doctors can come in on a locum basis or a rotational basis to cover off needs, but they don't have to worry about any of the non-medical functions. That's kind of what you're envisioning here in
exactly.
a way.
Exactly, right? And you should have written the book, because you're exactly describing the kind of thing that is possible. We don't graduate teachers from teachers' college and then expect them to go out and, you know, find a place to be able to set up shop in a school and find a few other people that will work with them and develop an entire curriculum for themselves. We have systems in place for school, and that's exactly what we need when it comes to primary care.
Jane Philpott, always good to talk to you. That's Jane Philpott, former health minister and author of Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochran. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.